this isn't just about horsepower.
It's about the culture behind the wheel.
From the latest automotive headlines,
to the machines we love, to the music, movies, and moments driving in the lifestyle.
This is Driveline with Justin Basic. If it's got an engine, an attitude, or a story worth telling, we're on it. Call in. Leave your take. 833-3DL-SHOW. This is Driveline. So let's strap in and let's roll.
Driveline, a lot going on this week. I just got back from a trip to Chicago. We talked to the photographer behind a famous alternative rock album cover. LAPD impounded 72 cars out of the LA River. And a car from a hit 2000s TV show is found at a local pickup art. So I got an email last week from my friends Tom and Marilyn. And if you want to send me an email, justin@drivelineshow.com. They say, Justin, does LA really have such a big problem with mosquitoes? We are enjoying your Driveline podcast and thought you might want to work this into Driveline. So I'm really glad you brought this up because I wanted to talk about this after my trip this week. It goes on. So Marilyn's looking over my shoulder right now saying, what does mosquitoes have to do with cars? Well, we don't have to talk about cars because this is Driveline sort of car show and we talk about whatever I feel like talking about and this is what I want to talk about. Okay. But Tom says, I can tell you why. I remember when I was young, if you drove at 60 miles an hour for a few hours, the front of your car would be plastered with thousands of dead bugs. But when we drive now, I only see maybe 1% as many dead bugs on the front of my car. Why? Fewer bugs? More aerodynamic cars. The mosquitoes have evolved to dodge cars. Look forward to seeing you. Okay. So, I just took a trip back to Chicago last week, and then up to our cabin near Rhinelander, home of the Hodag. If you're unaware, the Hodag is a fearsome critter resembling a large bull-horned carnivore with a row of thick, curved spines down its back. The history of the Hodag is strongly tied to Rhinelander, Wisconsin, where it was claimed to have been discovered. In 1893, newspapers reported the discovery of the Hodag in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. The reports were instigated by well-known Wisconsin land surveyor, timber cruiser, and prankster Eugene Shepherd, who I believe later went on to do a Christmas story. A photographer of the remains of the charred beast was released to the media. It was the fiercest, strangest, most frightening monster ever to set razor-sharp claws on the earth. It became extinct after its main food source, all-white bulldogs, became scarce in the area. The Hodag has featured prominently... There's a typo in their own article. The Hodag was featured prominently in early Paul Bunyan stories. The Hodag became the official symbol of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It is the mascot of Rhinelander High School and lends its name to numerous Rhinelander area businesses and organizations, including the annual music festival, Hodag Country Festival. So, while I was up in Rhinelander, home of the Hodag, the mosquitoes were absolutely terrible. And I saw this article put out by Orkin. Might be a little biased. Labeling Los Angeles remains worst mosquito city as health risks rise. Now, in the past month, I've seen one mosquito in Los Angeles. I've got no bites here. I saw one mosquito and it was in the hallway of my office. Going back to Rhinelander, Wisconsin, home of the Hodag, you could not be outside for 8 seconds and not get bit. To mention it, you can't even be inside for 8 seconds and not get bit. The mosquitoes, really, really bad there, to the point where it almost made me not want to... I regretted going on the trip. But Orkin goes on to say, As mosquito season kicks off across the U.S., Orkin's 2026 Mosquito Cities list reveals a significant shift in mosquito activity across the U.S. and where these unwelcome pests are making the biggest buzz. For six consecutive years, from 2015 through 2020, Atlanta held the top spot. Since 2021, Los Angeles has constantly ranked number one, making a shift in the highest levels of mosquito activity. So based on my own personal experience, I'm calling BS on this article. I spent a lot of time outside. I was working in the yard yesterday. I was messing with the sprinklers. I didn't see any mosquitoes. And frankly, I think LA just likes to be number one on every list. Beyond a nuisance, mosquitoes are the deadliest animal in the world, responsible for more than 600,000 malaria-related deaths each year. According to the CDC, in the U.S., they can spread serious diseases, including West Nile virus, Eastern equine encephalitis, and Zika. The rankings are based on the number of new residential mosquito treatments performed by Orkin from March 18, 2025 to March 18, 2026. So they're basing it only on the number of clients they have, which logically would make Los Angeles number one. Looking over the list, they have number one is Los Angeles. Number two is Chicago. Number three is New York. Other relevant northern cities. Minneapolis, which is close to Rhinelander, home of the Hodag. They are at number 13, up 6 points. San Francisco, kind of close to Los Angeles, is at number 18, down 3 points. Milwaukee and Wisconsin is at 23, up 15. Another northern West Coast city, Seattle, falls at number 24, up 2. Oklahoma City, down 2 at 26. Boston, for East Coast reference, is at number 34, up 6. Sacramento, California, is at number 39, which is new to the list. Phoenix is new to the list at 40. Sticking to California, San Diego at 45, down 6. Midwestern cities continue to see some of the fastest growth year over year, with Milwaukee jumping 15 spots to number 23 and Minneapolis coming 6 spots to number 13. At the same time, some historically high-ranking cities saw declines, with Miami and Greensboro, North Carolina, each dropping 5 spots. Changes like these underscore how environmental factors, including the spread of species like the yellow fever mosquito, are reshaping mosquito pressures across the country. To help reduce mosquito activity, Orkin recommends using the acronym BITE to remember key prevention steps. Block access to skin by wearing long sleeves and pants, as well as CDC-recommended repellents, because we don't like DEET anymore. Install tight-fitting screens on windows and doors. Trim shrubs, grass, and other vegetation to reduce mosquito resting areas. And eliminate standing water, which is a breeding ground for mosquitoes. For more mosquito facts and prevention tips, visit Orkin.com. Not sponsored. But yeah, the mosquitoes ruined my whole trip. I mean, I didn't get barely anything done I wanted to do up there because you couldn't spend any time outside or in without bites. I mean, my arm looks like I have some kind of disease. I also got a tick in my stomach, which I wasn't happy about. Something else notable about my trip that I wanted to talk about was gas prices. And not, oh, gas is expensive. It's more the structuring of how gasoline is sold pretty much in California versus the rest of the world is what I'm finding. So I spent, after I got back from Rhinelander, home of the Hodag, I went back to Illinois and spent a day catching up with some old friends. So I needed some gas. I went up to Lake Cook Road to the big shell labeled No Cook County Tax. And the sign just read regular $3.99. I'm like, okay, good. Gas is like $1.50 cheaper here than it is back home. Excellent. So then I get to the pump, and I'm looking at the grades, and they have regular for $3.99 as advertised. Mid-grade at 89 octane was $4.59, and 93 octane was 539. All of them were up to 10% ethanol. But there was a 60 to 80 cent jump between grades. Now, since I was using my mom's Mercedes GLC, I couldn't take any less than 91, so I was forced to pay the 539, which I feel was falsely advertised. At least in Rhineland or home of the Hodag, for 530, I could get 91 octane ethanol free. As it sits right now in my regular Shell station here in sunny Woodland Hills, California, regular is at 568, the mid-grade is at 588, and premium 91 octane at 608, which is only a 20 cent jump between grades, which is more expensive, but I believe more honest. I posted a picture of the gas pump complaining to my Instagram stories, and I got a number of responses, including, OMG, I just had similar in New York. Louisiana is like that too. I think it's because California is required to show all prices on the sign. In Louisiana, they only show you the price for regular, which was the case in both Illinois and Wisconsin. And someone said that's what happens when you use a shittier base for the premium, which I cannot confirm or deny is happening. 833-3DL-SHOW, 833-335-7469 for your comments on this matter. I'm curious what you think. What's gas in your area and how much is the difference between each grade of gas? And do you have ethanol or not? And do you use a shittier base for the premium? Normally, I take 2 weeks when I drive to visit Rhineland or home of the Hodag, but considering these gas prices and for the sake of time, I elected to fly. And it might just be a permanent thing. As much as I like a good road trip. And not only did I fly, but I did a first for me, and that was flying first. So when I was booking this flight, I decided to use my American Advantage Rewards miles. And it was interesting because I was looking through various times I could fly, and I ultimately elected to take the first flight out each time because less delays, and it's usually a little cheaper. Not as cheap as a red eye, but it's significantly less to fly at 6 a.m. versus 7. And I was looking to redeem my points, and I found a flight from LAX to O'Hare for 25,000 points. This was in row 33 or so with a window seat and boarding group 99. But for the return trip, I noticed very, very little variance in the price between row 33 and boarding group 99 and first class. 500 points to be exact. It cost me 25,000 points, LAX to O'Hare, O'Hare to LAX, 25,500 points. I was like, great, jump on it. I'm going to fly first class. Never done that before in my life. And unfortunately, I don't think I can ever go back. Now, when you've been flying since you were a kid and you've never flown first on a domestic, I highly recommend trying it because it is the closest feeling you're going to get to that first time on a plane as a kid. You fit in the seat comfortably. Everyone's always checking up on you. You get a great meal included. I got to pick my meal ahead of time. It's just like being a five-year-old on his way to his first trip to Disney World in 1996. Literally, flying first class is now what flying in coach used to be 30 years ago. So, deal or no deal, I'm probably going to wind up springing a little bit more for first class, but it still comes out to be about half the price of driving when you consider 4 to 6 nights in hotels in various cities across the country. You know, you wouldn't think, what is that town I always stay in? Evanston, Wyoming and them? Or no, Casper, Wyoming. You wouldn't think a hotel in Casper, Wyoming would be expensive, but when it's the only hotel for 300 or so miles, they're like 300 something bucks a night. So, first class all the way. Let's drive all those prices up together. But if you're wondering how my trip was overall, it rained more than not. That, with that and the mosquitoes, it was a pretty miserable time. But a simple family trip could lead to the highlight of your career. At least that's the case for Josh Welch. This week marks 9 years since the release of Portugal the Man's album Woodstock. You know it from the 7-time platinum number one single Feel It Still. And the album cover boldly features a burning Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow, a car I'm very familiar with. And the image repeatedly reappears all over social media. And Josh Welch, the man behind the iconic photograph, is joining me right now. So, a little background. I started at K-Rock here in Los Angeles in August of 2017. And at that time, Feel It Still was like the biggest thing ever.
That's right.
Yeah. And I remember seeing the image all over the place. Like, if you look, I don't know if you can see behind me.
I see it.
That's they came and played in our Red Bull sound space, and we were redecorating, so I swiped that poster off for my studio here.
Yeah, I see it. It's a story, and I've kind of got a story myself, but that photograph is a story in and of itself.
And
it's pretty amazing.
It's special to me, too, because I own a Rolls-Royce that's very similar to that. It's a white and gray Silver Shadow. And so, like, I see this image reposted all the time. Like, it crosses my social feeds. I always try and make a point to tag you in the comments because it's almost never credited.
Thank you. Exactly. No,
but,
I
like,
know.
Over and over, everyone's always saying, like, this is Photoshop. And then they give you a list of reasons why they think it's Photoshop. And, like, in the last year now, everyone's like, oh, this is an AI photo. This is AI slop. So I wanted to set the record straight.
We're going to set it straight, and I sent you two a video and a still image to prove that we're setting the record straight today.
All right. And you're a professional photographer.
That's right. So my name is Josh Welch, and I live in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I practiced law for about 15 years, and then I did professional photography for about 10 years, and now I'm back to law. I'm a criminal defense lawyer by trade, but I did do professional photography from about 2012 to about 2023.
Wow. So let's just get into it. What's the story behind the photograph?
Okay. So, you know, Oklahoma City is the home of the Flaming Lips. I guess you know the Flaming Lips.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm good friends with Wayne and Steven. And in 2011, I think Portugal the Man was headlining the Norman Music Festival. Norman is the home of the University of Oklahoma, outside of Oklahoma City. And so we went to go see those guys, and they needed a place to stay. Like, they were young kids and hadn't hit it big yet. And they were headlining this festival, but you know, musicians at that age, they're dead broke. And so we had them over, we fed them, we let them shower. And so I got to develop a relationship with John and those guys. And fast forward maybe to the end of 2012, I'm doing professional photography. I'm hired to photograph a float at the Rose Bowl parade on New Year's Day, 2013. And so I've got my big camera and I'm out there, and some alums that from Texas A&M that had a big float in the Rose Bowl parade wanted me to document it and photograph it. So I did. And then I had my family fly out the next day, and we were going to go to Disneyland, just a traditional Oklahoma family going to Disneyland in Los Angeles. And so my family comes out, we're in an Uber. I happen to have one of my nicer cameras because I was out there for a shoot, and we're on an interstate, and I honestly don't even know what interstate. I mean, I'm not driving. We have an Uber driver. I'm in the front passenger seat. My wife is in the back seat with our two boys, and there may be, I don't know how old they are, 12 and 9 or something like that. And as we're approaching down the interstate, I see this car that's on fire. And I see behind the car, I see a police car with its lights on and a group of people. And so I think, okay, I'm going to get my camera out. I'm going to see what this is all about. And it's just by happenstance that I have a nice one with me. And when I say nice one, I mean one that would take a good quality image and that you could blow up and print. And so I know nothing more about this than that. I see police cars, I see a group of people, I see a car on fire. So as the Uber is driving by the car on fire, I get my camera out and I spray it with about 10 or 12 shots, 10 or 12 frames. It's just literally just And it happens that fast. I mean, I think I had my aperture set at like 5.6, and I mean, I'm just fumbling with it. And then we probably got about, I don't know, 20 seconds down the road, 30 seconds down the road, and I'm flipping through, and I see the one that I've selected that is the image. And I look at that and I'm just like, can I cuss on this podcast?
Yeah.
Can I? I just look at that and I go, motherfucker, that is a vintage Rolls Royce. The flames, and this is the raw image, and I'm looking through the camera to see, and I knew instantly. I go, that's something special. Like, and so then we go to Disneyland. I had a laptop. I uploaded it. I played around with it, and I could just see that it was kind of an unbelievable image, and it's kind of classic. You can spend your whole life being a photographer and planning these shoots and doing all this kind of, I don't want to say meaningless bullshit, but all this stuff that you do, and then just out of nowhere, you get a chance to take a picture like that just by happenstance, by sheer luck. And I think Chase Jarvis, who's a well-known photographer, he has this saying where he says that the best camera is the one that you have with you. And that's 100% the truth. If I had not had a nice digital camera with me, like, this image wouldn't have been the same thing. And I showed it to my wife, and then I thought, you know, I knew it was a special image, but you never really know until you sort of put it out there and then how people react to it. And I'm not a car guy. I don't know. I mean, I think you're a car guy, and I think you have a car podcast. And so, you know, the history of this particular model and this year and Rolls Royces. And I don't know any of that shit. Like, I just know that I took the picture, but the way it's teed up, the color of the blue, the emblem on the hood, the whole thing, the way the flames are coming up through it, the fact that no one's in the frame, everybody's behind it, because even if you just put one or two people in that frame, then that picture's fucked. It's right. Not the same thing. And the stars just aligned for it. So I posted it. At some point, I played around with what I thought was the best image and put it on my Instagram. And because I had those, rewind back to 2011, when I told you I got to be friends with Portugal the Man, John and those guys, they DM'd me. It was maybe in 2015 or 16, and said, hey, we're recording this album with Danger Mouse, and it's going to be badass, Josh, and we want to use your image on the album cover. And I love those guys. Like, I'm a big Portugal the Man guy. I'm a big music guy, like with the Flaming Lips, and I'm a big indie rock guy. Like, I would have practically given them the image. I think we negotiated the use rights for it, and they paid a fee for it, but I would have. I mean, I love those guys. So I immediately said, well, of course I would. But I had no idea that they were going to come out with Feel It Steel and just blow the fucking thing up. I mean, I just had no idea. So it's like one thing after another. And then this image is being seen everywhere. And so I've got it on my website, and I think a print of it sells for, the bottom end is around $3,000, and the top end is around, I've sold it for as much as 12,000, depending on the size. But I try to keep it somewhat exclusive. Like, I'll only sell up to 100 of them. And the thing still, you know, about 8 months ago, the Bowery Ballroom in New York City, the gallery there, someone reached out and said, hey, I got someone that wants to buy this thing. I mean, people just contact me out of the clear blue and see it. But I was thrilled to death when John reached out, and that they had such a big hit, and that album is a part of their history. And their success. I mean, it just warms my heart. I couldn't be happier for it.
Has anyone ever reached out to you after this and said, like, hey, that's my car?
No, and I've Googled it, and I've tried to, you know, I've Googled the date. I've Googled, you know, everything at the time, because you look into it and you think, okay, is there someone in there? Like, you kind of could see an image or a shadow of something. And I just absolutely don't know the story of it. I don't know anything about it. I couldn't find any history of it or any record. And like you said earlier, people think that it's photoshopped, you know, because it's so perfect. It's one of those things that is so perfect. The flames, and I edited it. I didn't touch it with Photoshop, but I manipulated the colors as far as adding some contrast, a little bit of contrast. But that picture, the way that you see it is the way that it was taken, minus adding some contrast and sharpening it a little bit and things like that. But I didn't add or I didn't do anything to alter the image. And it was just the backdrop of it, the smoke. And you can see in parts of it, you can see the heat because it's blurry above it a little bit because of the heat. And just the color blue pops on it. And really, it's just that emblem on the hood is like perfection. It just, it's an amazing picture. And I felt honored just to be a part of it. It's been a big part of my story. It's by far the most successful photograph I've ever taken. And it's with some friends of mine whose music I love, who happened to have like the biggest hit maybe of the 2010-ish era. You know, I mean, I don't know a bigger song from 2010 to 2020 than that, Feel It Still. And I got to be a part of that. And I'll always be linked with those guys because of that. So it's special.
How can people find your work or hire you?
So that's kind of a tricky question. Because I pivoted back to law in 2023. And I don't do as much photography now. But my website is joshwel.ch. So it's kind of a Swedish domain, Switzerland domain. And whoever crafted that for me thought it would be unique, but it's a huge pain in the ass to have to explain to people. It's joshwel.ch, which is my name. And then you can see, you'll find that image on there. And I think I still have maybe 15 or 20 copies left of the run that I'm going to do on it. I'm not just going to sell that forever because I think it would take away from the image. It would saturate the market with it. And I think I set it at 75 or 100. I would have to look at it, but that website is still active. And again, I sold one to a gallery in New York maybe 6 or 8 months ago.
It's a great story.
And I would love to reconnect at some point with John and those guys. I didn't realize they were coming up on 9 years. I mean, it makes me feel like I'm getting old with that album.
Yeah, Tuesday was nine years since it came out.
Yeah, and so I get probably once a month, I'll get a buddy or someone, you know, who's listening to Spotify or Apple Music, and that song pops up, my photograph pops up, and they're like, hey, we just saw your picture on, you know, on Spotify or Apple Music, and it happens a lot. In my law office, I have that image blown up in my lobby where clients come in and see it. And no one believes that I took it because now they know me as a lawyer. They don't know that I was a part of that. But it's just there are certain things in your life that are really special to you that just happen, that you can't really explain why they happen. And this was one of them because it was with a group of guys. You know, John is one of the sweetest guys that I know, and they've worked so hard and were able to achieve so much success with that album. And just to be linked to it in any way, for me, is special. And the fact that image, the way that it happened with my family, you know, literally on a traditional family trip to Disneyland, this Oklahoma family is out in the big city of LA going to Disneyland. It's so cliche that it almost doesn't make sense. And then we see this thing and accidentally take this photograph and it just takes off from there. So it's just been a really neat thing for us.
Thank you, Josh. Josh Welsh. You know, the first time I ever saw that album, I thought to myself, this is an abomination. How could someone destroy that car just for their album art? And I'm happy to hear that wasn't the case. I'm still holding a grudge against you, Oasis, though. Funny how Josh didn't remember where the photo was taken, but thanks to the people on the Where Is This subreddit, we know that this was taken on the eastbound 105 freeway between Merkel and Downey Avenues, so if you're so inclined. Moving 12 miles north from there, drivers question LAPD towing 72 vehicles at the Los Angeles River car meetup near Cypress Park.
A major crackdown on the LA riverbed, literally dozens of vehicles impounded. After police targeted trespassers, all this near San Fernando Road, the Street Racing Task Force handed out citations and towed a staggering 72 vehicles during Sunday night's enforcement.
So I guess some drivers caught up in a weekend car meetup inside the Los Angeles River say police went too far as officers impounded 72 vehicles and issued multiple trespassing tickets near Cypress Park. The Los Angeles Police Department said the Street Racing Task Force responded around 6:30 p.m. Sunday to the 400 block of North San Fernando Road, where drivers had gathered inside the River Channel. Police have confirmed that the trespassing citations and impounds, the department has not said the gathering was an active street race. Drivers spoke with Fox 11, said they believe they were attending a photo shoot for the Los Angeles car community and not a street takeover. Alexander Pimienta, whose motorcycle was impounded, said the event was advertised online as a photo shoot with the Los Angeles skyline as the backdrop.
They have like some sign supposedly for trespassing. It's like the size of a piece of paper, not really readable or anything like that. We went down there, no bad intentions. We took some photos, that's it.
Now, the Los Angeles River access point over there off San Fernando Road was like the best kept secret. Magnus Walker uses it all the time. Like, it's an if you know, you know thing. And up to this point, if you went down there to take photos by yourself or with two other people, you were fine. And it's a little irritating that someone decided to host a whole event down there, advertise it publicly, and absolutely ruin it for everyone.
I guess some cars started going crazy for some reason. It was just supposed to be pictures.
Drivers say this was not supposed to be a takeover, and a small group changed the whole night.
They were doing some burnouts, they're messing around, being dumb, being idiots and all that, but hey, everyone's having fun, but they left and they got the cops called on us.
Angel Rodriguez, whose Ford Mustang was impounded. Again, Ford Mustang people ruined cars and coffee, and now they ruined the LA River. Said he had just arrived when the gathering began to change.
Some drivers say they didn't realize the River Channel was off limits, and now there's a possibility their vehicles may be held for weeks.
Some people are getting their cars held for 30 days. That's around $3,000 just to get it out. And we're all getting cited with trespassing.
I think it was probably a little too much for impounding everyone. Maybe a ticket would have been just fine for trespassing, because none of us knew it was a trespass, so pretty much a ticket would have just been fine.
The LAPD has not said whether or not the impounded vehicles will in fact be held for 30 days. Rodriguez says if the city did not want cars going into the River Channel, officials should make the entrance harder to access.
It's better a block so no one could enter, so better like so it doesn't happen again for other people. But it's a nice view to take pictures.
Why are you giving them that idea? Like I said, this was a good thing we had. And they ruined it for everyone. I'm a little peeved. Still haven't been down there yet. All right. I just wanted to brush up on this list I found really quick from Car and Driver with the most controversial cars of the 2000s so far. Now, I don't like the title of this because 2000s implies 2000s to 2010, but this is apparently all century-encompassing, so a lot of these cars on this list, I'm just going to skim through because they came out in the last month. At number one, they have the Ferrari Luce. Ferrari almost certainly has the highest multitude of fans and followers to actual paying customers, so when there's a huge audience of people to weigh in when Maranello makes big news, as it did in bringing out the Luce. The issue really is the look of the car. Going further, it seems not so much the styling as it is the vehicle type. A five-seat hatchback is not a vehicle that says Ferrari. The company almost certainly would have done better to serve up its first EV as a two-seat supercar. Again, we've gone into so much depth with the Ferrari Luce and the Pope and Lauren Fix, so I don't want to fixate on that. No pun intended. Number two, the Mercedes AMG GT four-door. Again, another car that came out literally like a couple days before the Luce. What seems to be the driving criticism of this electric AMG is the front and rear styling. We point specifically to the three-pointed star-eyed headlights, with the rather pedestrian light bar connecting them at the rear. Some find the oversized taillights within the huge back black panel to be a bit much. Yeah, I never paid that much attention to this car. To me, it just looked like a new BMW, which is what a lot of the criticism was about. Number three, the Jaguar Type 00. another car that we just saw the release of in the last month. The car's plainish styling could charitably be called brutalist, but Jaguar designers seem to be leaning entirely on extreme proportions to make a statement. The bluff front end is like a blank stare, and the lack of any rear glass comes across as a gimmick. Number four was the Dodge Charger EV. A little bit less recent, but still recent. Modern-day Dodge brand is built entirely on an old-school V8 gas-burning ethos. To think that fans of this brand were going to embrace clean, green battery electric power and Dodge's signature muscle car was next-level self-delusion. The 2024 Charger Daytona EV was a flop out of the gate. This despite styling that is pretty much spot-on, channeling the look of the mythical 68-70 Charger. Number five, we have the Tesla Cybertruck. First unveiled in concept form in 2020 with the Silicon Valley promise to disrupt the vast full-size pickup market, the Cybertruck suffered repeated delays in its slow trudge to production, yet despite its high school shop class appearance, its performance is impressive. Sales to actual customers, however, have been slow, and the Cybertruck has been a target of public derision in a way that other Tesla models are not. Okay, now we're getting into the part of the list that's a little more, let's say, 30-year encompassing. At number six, the 2002 Porsche Cayenne, which is honestly the first-gen Cayennes have become beloved at this point, but when it was released, Porsche had exclusively a sports car, has been a sports car maker up until the Cayenne arrived in 2002, and its heavy, high-riding off-roader seemed the antithesis of the brand's sports cars. The fact that the base engine was a Volkswagen-derived VR6 didn't help matters. Cayenne's strong straight-line performance and its surprisingly capable handling, combined with the buying public's mania for SUVs, made the Cayenne a success. That success undoubtedly emboldened other automobile brands to take the SUV plunge. And we saw a lot of other performance SUVs of the era. The Mercedes-Benz M-Class, which at the time was body-on-frame, which is still beloved by enthusiasts despite its initial weariness of being a US-made Mercedes, and the BMW X5, which the first gen, I love the styling of. I really, really wish they were more reliable. They have a lot of active handling controls that, when they fail, are basically unfixable. And you really don't see those anymore, but those are great-looking SUVs. Number seven, speaking of BMW, the BMW 7 Series. The E65 Generation 7 Series, which debuted for 2001, was credited to, and blamed on, design chief Chris Bangle, to the point that the rear end became known as the Bangle Butt. Although it's Adrian Van Hooydonk's signature that's on early sketches. Whereas previous BMWs were lean and athletic-looking, the E65 7 Series was laden and an eyebrow over the traditional round headlights seemed strange. The off-putting aspects continued inside, where drivers found a dainty column shifter that made way for the brand's first iDrive controller, poorly executed in the first go-around. Now, my favorite, quote, I guess you could say favorite, BMW, the BMW that got me into BMWs, the E60 5 Series, it's the same generation of this. I love the styling of it. It did have the iDrive controller, the first gen, and yeah, it was interesting to use. Basically, anything you wanted to control, there were no buttons at the time. Like they later created iDrive plus buttons, but the original iDrive was you got a knob that toggled, and if you wanted to adjust anything in the car, the volume, actually I think the volume had its own control, but if you wanted to change the radio station, if you wanted to change your AC fan speed, if you wanted to change where your air was blowing out of, everything about that car was in one controller, and it was very clunky to use. Number eight, the Pontiac Aztec, another car people love to hate that I hate to love. It was purely the styling that repelled buyers in droves. SUVs were the new hot product segment, but automakers were starting to realize that while buyers loved their tall shape, high seating position, and all-wheel drive, most really weren't using their off-road capability, and their body-on-frame construction had weight and fuel economy drawbacks. GM's solution was the Aztec and the related Buick Rendezvous, which, as the slightly less ugly sibling managed to look almost normal by comparison, was to create a high-riding SUV using a passenger car platform. It is the modern crossover formula, and all you have to do is stand in any parking lot today to see the rightness of the idea. Unfortunately, GM wasn't willing to modify the hard points on the minivan platform that underpinned the Aztec, which led to some dorky proportions. Slab sides, a disjointed side window treatment, copious plastic cladding, and a face only a mother could love sealed the deal, making the Aztec a punchline that still hits decades later. I think there's other cars that are better suited for that list, and honestly, I think anything that was put out in the last 48 months is a cop-out. So, let me know. Hit me up Instagram, at Driveline Show, or leave me a voicemail, 833-335-7469. What do you think is the ugliest cars of this millennia? And I'll even open it up. What do you think of the ugliest cars of all time? Homework for you. All right, so, lastly today, this was first published on The Drive by Andrew P. Collins. Pimp My Ride Ford Taurus just hit a pick-your-part junkyard in California. A 1989 Ford Taurus that was done up for a 2005 episode of Pimp My Ride just showed up in a Southern California junkyard. The custom paint and accessories actually weathered the last two decades pretty well, but I guess nothing lasts forever, which reminds me, dang, 2005 is more than 20 years ago. Over the weekend, this new entry into the Wilmington, California Pick Your Part yard, I mean, over the weekend, this was published June 8th, so it's been a few weeks now, and there's new updates on this, but the new entry into the Wilmington, California Pick Your Part yard inventory got shared to the Radwood Facebook group. I poked around a little, and yep, that is absolutely the same 1989 Taurus sedan that was modded in episode 37 of Exhibit's MTV show in the summer of 05. Now, Pimp My Ride was like one of my favorite shows at the time. Like, back before MTV was showing ridiculousness all day, they were showing Pimp My Ride all day. I mean, this was like, this was 2005. I was in middle school, and being a budding car enthusiast who didn't know a lot about good cars, I really thought what they were doing on Pimp My Ride was fantastic.
Oh, snap! It's Exhibit!
What up, homie? I'm here to pimp your ride.
Who the hell is that at the door?
I still have an episode of my iTunes library that I got for free on iTunes in 2007. Yep. Still have an active iTunes. It was season 5, episode 1, which I believe, no, it was the second season they did at Gas. But we're going to talk about,
this is actually season 3, episode 6.
I found out in the research of all this, there is a huge Pimp My Ride fandom online. And back in 2009 or so, the news broke that the Dodge Caravan, or maybe it was a Plymouth Voyager, I don't remember. It was one of those Dodge body minivans from the show came up for sale, which was famously restored by Freddie Tavares and then gifted to Hoovy's garage and dumped. And I think the Peterson still has it in their garage, but there is a full circle of YouTubers aside from this. And it was really exciting to find this because this is like, it's 2026 and there's still YouTubers out there making videos, like old school YouTubers that didn't have 6-7 figure budgets. And I think this is great. So, like, this is what I stumbled upon in researching this car that's currently in the junkyard.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Brain Shatter.
Brain Shatterer is his name.
I know it's been a little bit, which I say every time. So I got up for work at 4 in the morning yesterday and checked my YouTube messages and got a message that a Pimp My Ride car had appeared in a junkyard. They told me where to look. I looked it up, and it's in Wilmington, California at the LKQ pick-apart lot. And it is Richer's 1989 Ford Taurus.
So Brain Shatter actually has a pretty interesting YouTube channel, I guess. Like, his main focus is he's been tracking down for years all of the old cars from Pimp My Ride. He's got a list of what cars still exist, who still owns them, which ones are where. It's actually, if you're interested in Pimp My Ride, really look this up. Another one, the Simulation Prophet, who's, I guess, friends with Brain Shatterer. He did a pretty in-depth look at this Ford Taurus, too.
Just wanted to hop on here real quick and provide a little update on a video that I made about 4 years ago already, a long time ago. But it was on the Pimp My Ride car with Chase Taurus. It was season 3, episode 6. I see this car has been posted around a little bit today. At the time of that video, Riche still had her car from the show. I'm just going to link this video right here, screenshot it, and then link it down in the description so you can go watch it. It's going to have a lot more clips of the show, a little bit more info. But I believe from when I was talking to her, I don't have access to the messages anymore. We were talking on Instagram. I don't have the account anymore. But she basically said the motor blew on it shortly after the episodes, and I was able to pull the vehicle records from it. It does corroborate that story. So she got the car in like 2002. It had like 122,000 miles on it. Let me get the exact number for you guys just to make sure I'm not lying or spreading misinformation. Yeah, 122,000 miles. Purchased it in July of 2002. The episode aired in 2005. I don't have the exact episode date, but usually they got the car back, at least at West Coast, not the case in later seasons. They got the car back before the episode aired. It had 153,000 miles on it in April of 2005. And then in December 2006, when it failed its emissions inspection in California, it had 171,000 miles on it. It never said it passed emissions inspection.
So this guy did all my work for me. I really wanted to look all this stuff up, and it was thankfully done. So Brain Shatterer and the Simulation Prophet, check out their videos if you're interested at all in Pit My Ride cars. As far as the actual episode goes, you can find this episode and almost every Pit My Ride episode on the internet in all of its standard definition glory. So let's look at a little at this setup for this car.
Concept cars are imaginative. They change the way we think and blow away all expectations. Just like me, X to the Z exhibit. Unfortunately for my girl Riche, her 89 Ford Taurus is nothing but a dented up relic of the past.
Hi, I'm Riche. I'm 21, and this is my ride. I drive a 1989 Ford Taurus. My dream is to be a stunt woman, and I have done a couple stunts, actually. My car is just, it's crazy. Everything is wrong with it. My whole hood flew up and actually bent. Now is the whole hood supposed to fly up? Who has a Toyota rim on a Ford Taurus?
The Ford Taurus hit the scene in 89. It was futuristic, it was innovative, and it was a real head turner. What? 16 years later, the only thing Riche's Taurus is doing is turning stomachs. Hold on, man, there's so many dents. Hold on, you gotta soak it all in. You gotta stand back and look at it. This is not one of those things you could just glance over once. Let me take a look at it. She is aspiring to be a stunt woman, henceforth, the way her car is looking. Maybe she used this for stunts and they gave it to her for free. Maybe she got it from a T.J. Hooker episode. William Shatner, Heather Locklear had a show. There were cops, and he used to always jump across the hood of the car. You know what I'm saying? Always, no matter what. For no reason. How do you bend the top of the hood? How do you bend it? How do you bend both corners? What were you doing?
This episode is also famous because Tiffany Haddish is randomly in it.
Me and my friend Tiffany, she was in her car, I was in my car. We both kind of got a little bit distracted. And it was a fine guy across the street. And I was like, dang, look at him. And she was like, what? And I was like, ah! And she just kind of collided, and put, you know, on the side of my car. But we was looking at a really fine dude.
I got to meet Tiffany at a K-Earth Laugh Factory event a couple years ago. And she's the sweetest person ever. Spent about an hour just talking to fans after the show. She took pictures with everyone. Just a real genuine person. So Max Maddox from Donut Media actually went down to the Wilmington junkyard and, got some good video on where the car sits right now.
This is crazy. Look what I just found sitting in a junkyard. This is a Pimp My Ride car.
What the hell? Look at this.
I don't actually remember this episode, like what this was, but this is crazy. Look how this door opens. You can see there's a bunch of like wood left over from what looks like a subwoofer enclosure. I ended up finding the episode this car came from. The premise was that the owner, Rache, was an aspiring stunt woman, so they decided to put a bunch of weird doors on it just cause. They gave her memory foam seats for when she gets banged up, and there was a giant stunt cushion in the trunk so she could jump out of buildings on a whim. Weird, because the car doesn't actually look that beat up, so I'm not really sure why it wound up in the junkyard, but I definitely want to get a closer look at the inside.
Yeah, it's definitely disgusting. Check out the, like, material it was reupholstered with. You can see this was, like, painted silver, but it looks like absolute shit right now. I bet this thing looked bad when they built it, and it's just aged terribly ever since. All the good stuff has been taken for sure. Like, what's this? Center console. It's so weird, dude. Look at the hood scoop, too. What's going on here?
So the hood scoop is interesting because if you watch to the end of the show, they had like a, I don't know if it was like Lexan or plexiglass cutout in it with a bunch of RGB lights. And I think the thought process behind that was because her hood flipped up in front of her windshield that it had an opening in it or something. And the little center console thing was actually, you pushed a button and it would give positive affirmations, little affirmation voiceovers, but like it's interesting how all that was removed and no one really knows what happened to it.
I'm gonna try to get that fender off.
Dude, this is gonna be sick. I'm gonna put this in my room. Oh, there's like for sure like Black Widows and shit in here.
This thing is sweet.
I think a lot of the cars from the show are not exactly built to the highest caliber, so not entirely surprised to see this in the junkyard, but it's kind of sad. So a little bit of TV history going down the drain, but I get to keep a little piece of it.
So after he plucked the fender from the car, there was a little update on Brain Shatterer's YouTube comments. I guess the pickup part had set the vehicle aside from the regular yard, so they're trying to save it, what's left of it at least. I don't know who's going to want to save it, like, but it's, they're trying to make progress. That's this week's Driveline. I don't have a plan for next week yet, but I have a whole bunch of guests I'm trying to get on board. And in the meantime, leave your thoughts on Instagram at driveline.show or at justback. Email justin@drivelineshow.com. Leave your voice on 833-3DL-SHOW. That's 833-335-7469. buymeacoffee.com/driveline if you feel like paying for this free show. And we'll do it again. Bye-bye now.